Taxes Show.
People tell me that since I'm the announcer, it's not about me, Todd Wilkerson. They say that my job is to serve the host of the show, Eric Metaxas.
What nonsense. I've known Eric for years, and you can take it from me. You just can't depend on him.
Mark my words, one day you'll blink and he'll be gone.
Off to fleece the next group of suckers.
But I'll always be here, no matter what, right here for you. Put your feet up and tell me all about it. Oh, yeah. And now your host.
If he's even still showing up.
Eric Metaxas.
What a hypocrite.
Oh.
Man, that Todd, ooh, he burns me up. Hey, folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Albin, you know what today is?
What day is
today
it?
Today is Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
And today we're going to go literary on you, folks. Big time literary. A few friends, Martha Linder of Lakeland, Florida, and a number of other friends said, have you heard of this book, A Gentleman in Moscow?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. And they proceeded to tell me about it. And it's this marvelous book. You've got to read it, blah, 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 blah. And people say these kinds of things to me, but I never have the time to read anything. Well, I read this book, and it's a spectacular book. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to get the author on to talk about it?
Yeah.
And Albin, I don't know how you did it, but you got him.
Well, his name is around the corner.
He lives around the corner.
I knocked on his door. Hey,
his name is Amor Towles.
Yes.
He is a spectacular writer. I say this as someone who cares very deeply about writing, about literature. He's written a few novels, but we're going to have him on this program. I think it's both hours today.
He is
just so interesting, and his books are written. They remind me of Mark Helprin in a way.
Yeah.
Which is a very high compliment.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, we're going to be talking literature today on this program. Some days we talk about faith. Some days we talk about politics. Some days we talk about whatever. Today we're talking literature.
Some days drama.
Drama?
Yeah.
We talk about drama?
Once in a while.
All right. Now, before we go into that, before we get literary, I have to say that we're doing a fundraiser for Christian Solidarity International. Ladies and gentlemen, this allows me to tell you about what I did last night. Last night, as you know, whenever we do a fundraiser on this program, which is, you know, every other month or something like that, I throw it out there that, you know, we want everyone to participate. So it doesn't matter how much you give. We just want everybody to participate and to kind of be all in, right?
Yes.
But some people can give more and other people can give a lot more. And so we have a scale of things that we want to do to incentivize you. So the highest level, if somebody gives $10,000, I always say, we would be delighted to spend the evening with you to have dinner together at, you know, wherever you choose. You come to New York, you pick a restaurant, bring your friends, whatever, and we can spend the evening together.
Yeah.
Because that's my way of saying thank you for such a huge gift to an organization that I think is doing God's work in the world today. So CSI, right now we're doing a fundraiser for them, and they're as good as it gets. But a year ago, we did something with CSI, and a guy, I won't use his real name, I'll just call him Brad Huff, gave this top amount. He and his wife gave this top amount, and it took us a year to schedule the dinner because they don't live around here, and I travel a lot and this and that. But we went to a restaurant that 3 years ago was, you know, the Michelin guide, the Michelin whatever, they rated it. Three stars, which is like insane. Okay. No, there's no restaurants practically they get one star. Mm-hmm. So if you get three stars again, and 3 years ago they were rated literally the best restaurant.
And those are the tire people, right? The Michelin,
right?
Yeah.
No. You're thinking of Firestone.
Oh.
Michelin is the food people.
Okay.
But it's rated three stars, and 3 years ago this restaurant, 11 Madison Park, was rated by these, you know, super duper foodie people as the best restaurant in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there last night. And let me just say this. It's not a restaurant. It's an experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, I'm not here to go into it. But sometimes you experience something and you just say, what was that? Like, that was mind-blowing. It was absolutely mind-blowing. But the real reason I'm saying this is that these people, I love meeting these people who are giving generously to these things that I care about. I love thanking them. And I don't care if we go to a burger joint. Like, this is not the point of it.
Right.
But last night I got to meet these wonderful people and a friend of theirs who will be on the show eventually. But there are people out there who can give that kind of money. And I want to say, first of all, it's a joy to spend that time with these folks and just to get to know them and to thank them in person. But these organizations depend on every one of us. So there are very few people who can give that amount. But whatever you can give, Albin and I have determined that anything you give to CSI, you get entered into a drawing. And you can win a free visit to the studio. You can bring in your whole classroom, your family. We don't care.
Right.
And and we have all these books that we're going to give away and stuff. Yeah. So we want to focus on the drawing, okay? So that if you want to enter the drawing to win a visit to the studio and all kinds of signed books and all this kind of stuff, all you have to do is give something
right
to Christian Solidarity International. So the way to do that, because, you know, you may be coming to New York in the next year or so, and wouldn't you be bummed if you thought, you know, I could have done that. I could have come to the studio. Because people say, can we come to the studio? And the answer is invariably no, but we can't have people just coming in
right
here. But, you know, if anybody gives $1,000, that gives them the ability to come here with their family and hang out with us and do all that stuff. But to enter a drawing to win that, you give anything. You can give $20, whatever you can give. So I want to tell you, here's the phone number, but we're suggesting you go to MetaxasTalk.com and, you know, click on the banner, Christian Solidarity International, and to give that way. But there are people out there who'd rather pick up the phone. And again, we're trying to get everybody to give something. So before we go to our spectacular guest, Amor Tolles, I'm going to give you this number, 800-253-3522, 800-253-3522. I'll give it out again at the end of the program. But we are freeing slaves in Africa. Think about this, folks. In Africa today, radical Muslims believe in slavery, okay? We know that people who believe in the Bible eradicated slavery. But if you are a member of radical Islam, you are likely to believe that slavery is okay, especially if you're enslaving people who don't believe the way you do. This is happening in Africa now, today, and we can do something about it. The bad news is human beings are being enslaved for their faith, for their Christian faith, or for not having the right kind of radical Muslim faith. But the good news is we could do something about it. The good news is you can do something about it by giving anything to CSI. So go to MetaxasTalk.com and click on the banner. The phone number is 800-253-3522, 800-253-3522. Now, I got to tell you, if you give $250, you're providing freedom for one human being who was enslaved. Think about what you're doing. $250, which is nothing in America. There are people who can do this. We buy all kinds of things for, you know, whatever. Maybe you can do half of that. Maybe you can do a fifth of that. But every $250 provides freedom for a slave. And not just that, but they get set up. CSI sets them up with a goat, which yeah provides milk and cheese and blah, 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 and other kinds of aid and food and all kinds of stuff. They get a fresh start, a new life. They get support. CSI knows how to do this, okay? They know how to buy them out of slavery. They give the slave the people who are enslaving these people are given a vaccine for their cows. And that's the way they trade. And they say, if we give this vaccine to help you with your cows, will you give us this person back
yeah
into freedom?
Yeah.
It's one of the most marvelous things. I want to give you the phone number again. There's a lot more information, but you can go to MetaxasTalk.com and give there. But folks, I'm begging you, give something. Just give something. 800-253-3522. 800-253-3522. 800-253-3522. 800-253-3522. 3522. God bless you as you give. We'll be right back with Amor Tolles.
Sailing softly through the sun in a broken stone age dome.
big screen that showed us the sun, but not as bright in life as the real one. It's never quite the same as the real one. And tell me, Gracie, how does it feel?
Hey, folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Have I got a treat for yous? Is that the current plural that we're using? Yous, you all, you guys. I'm sitting here in the studio with someone that I consider an actually great writer. Pretty rare, if you know me. I'm a little critical, especially of contemporary writing and contemporary fiction. But months ago, a friend of mine, I think it was my friend Martha Linder in Lakeland, Florida, said, "Have you read this book, A Gentleman in Moscow?" And I said to her what I always say, like, no, I never get to read anything these days. And she went on and on and on, told me the story. Well, I read the book, and then I realized that the author, who pronounces his name correctly, we'll ask him when we get him on the program, that he lives in New York, not many blocks away from this very studio. And maybe if we fool him and don't tell him all the dark secrets about me and the people who work here, maybe we could lure him into the studio. And we've succeeded, and here he is. Amor Towles.
Thanks,
welcome,
Eric,
to this program.
It's nice to be here.
I am thrilled to have you. We don't, you know, I don't get to talk to writers too much. You really are a spectacular writer, and I'm just so glad to talk to you about your books and about the art of writing. And then just before we went on this before we went live here, we realized that we were both at Yale at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the same college.
In the same college.
And the same major.
Yeah, certainly in the dining hall, we would have seen each other from a distance.
This is madness. And I know we're about a year apart, so you must have been late your year. I skipped a grade. But we were actually there at the same time. Let's start at the beginning. I mean, your book, A Gentleman in Moscow, is a very big deal. It's been a huge bestseller, and rightfully so, because it is incomparably, this is the phrase I would use, at least this phrase, it is incomparably delightful, meaning that just about every page contains several delightful things and makes the reading experience magnificent. I'm not here just to make you blush, but that's a big part of why I'm here.
Okay.
But how did this all get started? Because, you know, to be an English major at Yale, when you and I were there, the English department and the humanities had been kind of taken over by, what did Harold Bloom call them, the school of grievance or something like that, that all the deconstructionists.
Okay. Yeah.
So to actually appreciate
absolutely.
Writing in the way that you seem to and that I do, it was really not in fashion.
Yeah, I guess to answer your question, by going back to the beginning, it would be first grade. You know, in terms of, I am one of those writers, and I've met many who are similar, where I began writing basically at the time I began reading. You know, and I remember very vividly my first grade teacher, Mrs. Gom, bringing to class a local poet. It was a published poet and probably in his 60s, named David McCord. He read from his poems. At the end, he sold some books to us. And I just remember thinking this was amazing. What a cool thing what this man is doing. I went home with his books, and that night I began trying to copy what he was doing in poetry.
And you were in first grade.
First grade. And from that kind of moment forward, as I would read, write. You know, I would find an author that I was interested in you know, obviously at an early age, the Hardy Boys and that sort of thing, and eventually Agatha Christie, and then eventually, you know, the great 19th century novelists and what have you. But in each case, I would find somebody, delve into their writing, sort of steal what I could, copy it a little bit, because it was, as I say, the two passions, reading and writing, were married from the beginning. So by the time I arrived at Yale, the study of literature and the writing of fiction were really my primary interests, and I was pursuing the study of literature at Yale very much as a foundation for writing.
That's just so amazing, and it's so refreshing, because I know that when I was there, it was hard to do that, and that there were many classes you could take in the English department or the lit department that didn't seem to have the kind of appreciation that the two of us have for literature. I mean, they would look at a 19th century novel, and instead of just appreciating how delightful Middlemarch is, they would kind of, you know, tease out the political implications or that kind
you're
of
right.
thing.
And of course, right before the era that you're talking about, where we were both there, the great school of study at Yale was New Criticism, where it was the opposite, where you know, that group, Cleanth Brooks and
Robert Penn Warren.
Robert Penn Warren.
Whoa.
You know, their mindset was you pick up the poem or you pick up the story, you pick up the novel, and you study it for what it is. You know, you don't bring in your the biography of the author, or, you know, Freudian psychology, or the sociopolitical implications of Marxism, or any of those, you know, or more political topics. You look at the work of art as itself, and you study it closely in the way it's constructed and what it can mean to any reader. And so that's kind of the school that I was coming from, and I certainly sought out the teachers who were still at Yale.
Well, you were wise enough to be able to do that. I just kind of stumbled in. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Boston area.
In the Boston area. You're not going to be more specific.
Dedham, Massachusetts.
Dedham.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I lived in Boston for a couple of years. Did you go to private school? I mean, were you pursuing this while you were in high school? Was this still alive for you?
I went to a private school named called Noble and Greenough, which is, you know, an old... I am a New England WASP, you know, and at the school was kind of from the WASP, you know, private schools of New England, that tradition. But certainly I was studying literature and writing while I was in high school as well.
So when you graduated, though, I know that you didn't leap into writing. You leapt into the world of finance.
Yeah. I right after Yale, I spent 2 years at Stanford getting a master's in English, where I also wrote and studied more literature. But then when I came to New York at the age of around 25, I was looking for income, as it were, and company, you know, because writing alone at the age of 25 is pretty solitary. And so I joined a friend of mine who had started an investment firm, and 20 years later, we still were working side by side. So I did have that extended detour.
I mean, listen, when we think of people like, you know, Wallace Stevens, the idea that you could have a career doing something that different from writing fiction, or in his case, poetry, I mean, that alone is kind of remarkable. I'm trying to think of people that have done that.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because certainly when I first went to work in the finance arena, heroes of mine, T.S. Eliot, William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, one aspect of why they were heroes of mine, aside from the fact that they were, you know, terrific writers, was that they had all had careers. And so I think I had sort of the hope that, I think you can do these two things, you know, if you keep your mind on it. And but, you know, I had my fingers crossed that you could do those two things.
It's pretty impressive. I don't know if you know the poet Dana Gioia.
Yes.
He was the head of the National Endowment for the Arts, I guess, under Bush. And it's the same case. I mean, he had this big career in General Electric and stuff, and then he writes these glorious poems. But what is interesting, I guess, if I think about what your writing has is that you're not – it's not pretentious. You're actually trying to delight the reader. That alone is something that I think fell out of fashion in among the modernist writers of the 19th century. It's almost like they were writing for themselves. I'm saying 20th century. They seem to be writing for themselves or fellow writers. You see this a lot in the MFA programs that, you know, I'm trying to write poetry to impress other poets. And that sense of trying to delight an audience who are not themselves writers or academics seems to have been lost. And you are very much in that school. What do you think made you pursue that?
Well, I am a complete believer in what you just said, so it's an easy question for me to answer.
It's kind of its
own path. Having, you know, begun reading as a young person, and then, you know, gone to college, gone to graduate school, where you're reading a lot of fiction along the way, all different genres from different periods, from different places. At Yale, there's no question about it that the received wisdom for our generation was that great art is something you make solely for yourself. You never consider the audience, for sure.
You know,
that was the received wisdom.
In the middle of this sentence, there's a semicolon, pause. We're going to be right back. Okay. This is the 11? Did I get that wrong? I'm sorry.
No,
we actually have a minute, so you're allowed to finish that wonderful sentence.
Okay. So the notion is that I think that we were taught in sort of a generation that you write it for yourself as an artist, and if you're making it with the audience in mind, you're corrupting the work. And in retrospect, That's a crazy idea, you know, because for a thousand years, art was made with an audience in mind, and not just for commercial reasons. And so I think I have evolved to a point where what I try to do in writing is I write the first draft for myself, where I follow all my instincts. But when I start to edit, I edit not with a commercial audience in mind, but with a reader in mind. I try to make the book
better. In this day and age, folks, that's called crazy thinking, revolutionary thinking. We'll be right back with Amor.
Yes, Tolles.
Tolles. Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to the author of A Gentleman in Moscow, a genuinely great novel. You know me. I don't say that very lightly and certainly not very often. He's right here in the studio, and it is pronounced Amor. Tolles, Amor Tolles, just a joy to speak with you.
Thanks,
on every
sir.
Level. There's so many connections that it's hard for me to shut up, and I apologize to you and to my audience. We were talking about the this notion that reigned very much in the 20th century, that to write for the people, to write for the reader, to paint a painting for someone to take delight in was sort of bourgeois and backward, and that we needed to do something that said something. You know, it's like the futurist school of poetry or whatever. It's very, I just find it very, very pretentious, and it's remarkable to me that you escaped that kind of thinking, that you do write to delight your reader. It's obvious from this very delightful book, A Gentleman in Moscow, just every page.
And I'm not alone in that in my generation, but I think out of the We look back at Dickens, we look back at Tolstoy, we look back at Dostoevsky or Whitman, you know, these great writers of the 19th century. They all were very interested in crafting original art and a deeply felt story, but at the same time, they wanted it to reach an audience and for it to trigger sentiments in the audience, to trigger ideas, and to fascinate and engage. And so there is that balance between, which I think is an appropriate balance in art, which is to kind of pursue your own instincts and your own creative passions, but then to sort of shape those instincts and that artistic effort with the audience in mind and make the work better so that it's not boring. It's not redundant. It's not obscure. You know,
but people, of course, could criticize that as saying, like, "Oh, you're being sensitive to the market." In other words, you're selling out. You're not writing something that's pure. You're writing something that responds to people who will pay for it, which, of course, is mostly nonsense and kind of presupposes what, like an early 19th century romantic view of the artist, that you're somehow, you know, beyond good and evil, and you're just going to express yourself, and that people have to kind of play catch up, and you're not going to help them.
And I mean, as long as we're, I think the nuance here that's worth considering is there is a difference between writing for your reader, let's say, or painting for an observer, and doing it with a commercial intent. You know, and that is a difference. And you can write with commercial intent and do it very effectively, but it's very, I think, hard. If you are looking at the great writers, they're pushing back to some degree the commercial intent, because you don't want that to start making decisions for
Correct.
You that don't serve the story.
So it is a balance. That's exactly right.
That's right.
And you achieve that so beautifully. Let's focus a little bit on the novel that I have in front of me, A Gentleman in Moscow. Now, this is your second novel.
It is.
The first one came
Rules
out
of
when?
Rules of Civility came out in 2011.
Okay. After I've read that, I'd love to have you back to talk about that.
My pleasure.
I'm already really champing at the bit to read that. But this book, which I've read recently, it's so delightful. And I just have to tell you, you know, at the risk of embarrassing you, that when I first when I was reading the first pages, I was in awe of what you have accomplished. To do what you've done in this novel, speaking as a writer, is hugely ambitious, and to pull it off as successfully as you have, it's no wonder that this book has been a smash bestseller, because there are very few books like this out there. So tell us, if you would, the plot first, so my audience is not entirely in the dark of A Gentleman in Moscow.
I mean, because it's a very simple premise at the end of the day. The book opens at a Bolshevik tribunal in 1922, where a 30-year-old aristocrat is being interviewed. And in the course of this brief interview, it becomes clear that he wrote a poem as a young man that was very popular with the revolutionary generation. So he has some friends in the party, as it were. But it also becomes clear he's an unrepentant aristocrat. So as something of a compromise, the tribunal decides the count can go back to the hotel where he's been staying, the historic Metropole Hotel, and if he ever comes out again, he will be shot. And that begins the novel, and you spend 32 years in the hotel with the count. And I think that one of the things I'm proudest of about this book is that it has reached people and they've enjoyed it, despite the fact that it takes place almost entirely in a single space, in Soviet Russia, because that's, on the surface, can be a rather off-putting description or premise. But one of the things that makes the book fun, made the book fun for me to write, is I think of it a little bit in the tradition of say, Moby Dick. I'm not comparing myself to Melville, who's a great hero of mine, but if you think of Moby Dick as a great book, 90% of that book takes place on the boat. We follow Ishmael onto the boat, and we don't get off again until the last page. And for Melville, that's a challenge. How do you keep the reader interested when you are stuck in this space with this small band of, in that case, men? And he does it by bringing the world to the boat. And that was the challenge, the same challenge that I faced in Gentleman in Moscow, which is, how do you bring the world to the count while he's trapped in this hotel? And that's, you know, I think, the most fun about it for me, and from a writing standpoint.
It's, obviously, Moby Dick is one of the greatest novels ever written, at least in my estimation. But you're quite right that the idea initially, you're tempted to be put off by the suffocation idea that, oh, I don't want to be in this hotel. But you really magically open it up, and it's precisely the opposite of suffocating or claustrophobic. It's spectacular. We're going to be right back. Folks, I'm talking to Amor Towles. The book is A Gentleman in Moscow.
Lest too far we wander, love's sweet voices calling yonder. Shine, little glower, glimmer, glimmer. Hey there, don't get dimmer, dimmer. Light the path below above and lead us on to.
Hey there, folks. I love Supertramp. I love ELO, Elton John, and the Mills Brothers. And it seems to me that the Mills Brothers, we didn't plan this, but they would have become big stars around the time that this book starts. 1922. Right. So you have this aristocrat, 30-year-old, confined to this hotel. Now, how plausible is this? These are the questions we get to ask authors, right?
Yeah, like, sure.
Is this, did the Soviets do this kind of thing, or is this a little bit fanciful?
I think there's two things worth noting for sort of American readers. First, let me say that I know of nobody who was confined to house arrest in a fancy hotel in the Soviet era.
Right.
I don't know anybody who was. I think the two things that are interesting to note are, first of all, because I think this would surprise most Americans, is that we don't have perfect numbers on this, but something like a third of the nobility in Russia remained in Russia after the revolution. So obviously a significant portion fled to Paris and New York and London. Some were imprisoned or died in the war or were executed. But about a third stayed and continued to live their lives known as aristocrats. And they were called former people by the Soviet powers. They had limited rights. In some cases, they were even allowed to live in their old mansions. But what the Bolsheviks would say is, all right, the entire family is moving to the nursery, and we're going to take over the rest of the mansion. And so kind of to humble them, they would all have to kind of crowd into the sort of one room on the top floor of their mansion. But so that's the first thing. There were aristocrats who continued to live in the Soviet era and either struggle or thrive. The second thing is that house arrest has existed in Russia forever. It existed under the czars, certainly has existed under the Soviet era, and in a variety of forms, including you're going to Siberia or Pushkin, the Shakespeare of Russia. The czar at one point became worried about his reliability, and so he bought him an apartment across from the Winter Palace and said, "You're living here," just to keep an eye on him. So sort of the book in a way merges these two ideas, is that house arrest existed and that there were aristocrats wandering around the city, and it sort of comes out of that, I suppose.
The hero of the story, Count Alexander, comes from, how do you say it, Nizhny Novgorod? Can't remember. How do you say it?
You did as well as I would do. What? I don't speak Russian. Yeah.
Nitsky Novgorod.
Okay,
as soon as I read that, I thought of Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
Isn't Solzhenitsyn from that place?
Well, you're over my head. I love Solzhenitsyn, but I've forgotten where he's from. Well, you may well be right.
It's kind of funny because I just had on this program the son of Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Wow.
Ignat Solzhenitsyn lives in New York. He's a brilliant musician, conductor, famous. But we had him on this program talking mainly about his father. We need to have him back to talk about himself. But so as soon as I read that, I thought that's Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
Now, I can't help but ask you, my mother grew up in Germany, which became East Germany, and escaped. My father was in Greece, and before he left, the communists, there was a civil war there. So I was raised here in New York to hate communism.
Sure.
And we've grown up, especially places like Yale, where it's really not hip to hate communism. It's much more hip to criticize America. And I thought in reading this book, you brilliantly capture how brutal and oppressive and dehumanizing communism is without it being a difficult read like the Gulag Archipelago or many books like that. But where do you get your worldview, or do you have a worldview with regard to communism? It seems that you do in the book.
I certainly didn't write the book thinking about a statement to be made about communism. I think you discover your worldview often through the writing process. I mean, I leave my books wiser than I start them, without a doubt, thanks to the characters and their insights and their experiences, which I haven't been through, but you follow them through their experiences and you learn from it. But I think you've put it well, which is that I'm certainly not an apologist for communist society, and Stalin is one of the great criminals of the 20th century. But I think it's easy for Americans to forget, particularly, we were raised in the Cold War, where everything in Russia was bad and all the people were bad and communism was bad. But they were our enemies. So it's natural for that to be the story in America. But of course, the vast majority of Russians were just leading their everyday lives. They did not, those in the aftermath of the revolution didn't necessarily seek out desire to be communist. They certainly didn't desire to have a totalitarian society, develop around them. They led struggles. And I'm very interested in what is, in essence, the everyday heroism that existed in Russia in the 20th century. Artists who were told, playwrights were told, we're going to tell you how to write your plays. Architects who were forced to make the same building over and over again out of concrete. But obviously people were not allowed to practice their religion. There were all manner of ways in which their lives were being limited, and yet they bore up against that and continued to get married, to fall in love, to have children, to hope for the best for their children, to pursue their ideals internally. And so, yes, I was kind of interested in how does that individual heroism take place in what is a very dark period for a nation as a whole.
Yeah, you managed to convey the wider horror without dwelling on it in a way that makes for a difficult read. And I think that there's a place for difficult reads and difficult movies, but I think sometimes we get hung up on this idea that everything has to be difficult and that every act of reading or watching a movie has to be almost like, a social justice moment, that I have to suffer and see something and to be delighted. Again, this is, it's a bourgeois idea. I don't want to be delighted. I want to fight the system.
Yeah.
And in your book, you manage somehow to be extremely delightful on every single page in the great writing and the observations, while still making it clear what these folks are dealing with.
I appreciate your point of that. I really viewed that as the greatest challenge in writing the book, which is how do I create a human hero who is pursuing joy just like any of us in their daily lives, and compassion and friendship and simple pleasures, while doing justice to how difficult life was in Russia and trying to strike that balance. Because I wasn't going to write the Gulag Archipelago. Solzhenitsyn did that. I would never assume that I could do that. So I am writing a different book, and I had to strike that balance, and that was certainly the biggest challenge in the story.
We're going to be right back with Amor Towles. The book is A Gentleman in Moscow. Highly recommended. Hey there, folks. That's Jackson Brown. I'm Eric Metaxas, and my guest is Amor Towles. He's sitting right here. The book is A Gentleman in Moscow. Of course, there's also Rules of Civility, which we'll get to talk about in the future, I hope. Reading your book, I thought of course, a little bit of Solzhenitsyn. I thought of Nabokov. I thought of Mark Helprin. And I couldn't help think of Wes Anderson's films, not just because he did the Grand Budapest Hotel, but because of the pleasure he takes in some of the things that you take pleasure in your writing, and that you give pleasure to the reader in your writing.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me you draw that. I think Anderson, I've never met him, but if I look at his films, I look at my novels, I think we clearly share a certain sensibility. We enjoy finding an intricate little world and investigating it in all of its quirky detail.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Well, I have to ask you, there's certain things I was reading about in the book, and I thought to myself, whoever wrote this book obviously understands cuisine and cooking. How did that come about? Because you describe precisely how this great chef is supposed to cook the lamb or this or that. And how did you come to know about that world?
I do a lot of the cooking in my family. So perhaps not surprisingly, almost all of the major dishes that are described in the course of the novel are things that I cook for my family. So yes.
Alvin, we want to go to his house. Yeah. He lives a few blocks from here.
Well, you know, it's
That's funny.
Funny.
That's funny.
One of my favorite dishes in the book is that there is a Latvian stew. The Count is in the main dining room.
Apricots.
Yes.
Just the description of that.
Yes.
When it said apricots, I thought, whoa.
Yes,
I would have not expected apricots.
If you Google Amor Towles and Latvian stew, it will take you to where I've written an essay, and there's the recipe. So you can do that. Eric, you can cook that
dish. So then my purpose in this interview is fulfilled.
Yeah.
I get to make the Latvian
it's
stew.
It's a perfect fall-winter dish, so please do that.
Man.
Yeah. But yeah, so I do love the food. And going back to sort of this broader topic that we're having about the novel and what it can do and what it doesn't do and how it's evolved, as I've gone around the country, people will say, you know, it's so, you talk about food a lot in your books. And, you know, there's meals and, you know, and kitchens and you know, recipes and things like that, or at least, you know, descriptions of how food is made. And in retrospect, I mean, I wasn't very conscious of that. But in retrospect, kind of what's surprising to me in a way is that more novels don't talk about food with greater frequency. Because if you think about it, it's so central to our lives, right? I mean, we eat three meals a day. It's where we gather with our family on a daily basis. If we have children, it's how we date. It's how we celebrate holidays. You know, like we're about to go into Thanksgiving.
I think a lot of people eat food. In fact, almost everyone I know eats food.
Yeah.
But very few people cook food on the level you're describing. And this is the thing. There's kind of a fussiness, and I say that in a good way. You're not just talking about cooking a meal. You're talking about cooking a meal in a fine hotel. So I'm guessing that in your years in finance, you traveled around and you were exposed to that level of hospitality in fine hotels. And it's not normal.
Yes. The truth is, it's funny, the Jackson Brown that was just playing from Running on Empty, when my first job as a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, was doing dishes in a restaurant kitchen, which was a very simple restaurant. But it had the same kind of precision that you would see in a fancy restaurant at the end of the day, or that is described in the book. That's probably where I really kind of got my first sort of taste for the precision of a kitchen. They have to be minute by minute, second by second, part by part, watching, you know, 100 different dishes that are being made simultaneously. And they really are like little battalions, little army, but, you know, special forces units.
I see how our paths have diverged, because when I was 12 years old, my first job was washing dishes in a restaurant. That restaurant was nothing like what you've just described. It was kind of a slow diner, you know, ham sandwich. It was nothing like that. But I find it interesting that from such an early age, you've been able to observe this. You obviously have a novelist's eye, which is good because you're a novelist. Going to a break. We'll be back in hour two. More with Amor Towles.